My talk is called What is a Substance? Substance is a very important topic in metaphysics. Indeed, for metaphysicians like Aristotle, it's the central and dominant topic. Unfortunately, metaphysicians disagree not only about the nature of substance, they also discuss different things under the label substance. It's easy to get tangled up, and it takes careful analysis to just make sure that you're making sense. Putting it differently, if you aren't careful, you can be so far off track that you aren't even wrong. In this talk, I'm going to lay out a few different senses of substance, but I'm going to focus on just two of them, and really on just one of them. Another way I'm going to restrict my remarks is by mostly talking just about the views of Aristotle and, surprise, surprise, Aquinas. Near the end, however, I will say some things about relatively recent approaches to substance so that you can see more clearly what's special about the Aristotelian Thomistic approach. I've just said that metaphysicians discuss different things under the label substance, but actually that's misleading. Aquinas and Aristotle never, ever use the word substance. After all, English is not a language that they use. It's fun to think about the fact that I couldn't resist sticking this in here. Aquinas could have written in English if he had bothered to. It would have sort of been like Chaucer. And you do occasionally run across an Anglicism in Scotus's Latin. By contrast, of course, Aristotle could not have written in English no matter how hard he tried, because the English language just didn't exist then. Sorry to get off track like this. I was saying something about the word substance and about the fact that our two main guides, Aquinas and Aristotle, never use it. Aquinas does use a pretty close cognate, namely substantia. But weirdly, substantia is not the Latin translation of the Greek word that you think it should be a translation of, namely hypokaimenon. Instead, it's a translation of the word ousia. So linguistically, things are puzzling, and it's important not to let oneself be tempted too strongly by one's own intuitive sense, what a word like substance, quote-unquote, really means. It's better to keep a close eye on how it's used by each philosopher and what philosophical context it's used in, and how the philosopher you're reading explains it. Even your favorite philosopher might mean by substance or any other word something rather different from what you think he must mean. You must listen carefully to your master's precepts, including those of the master of those who know. Let's begin by considering what you might call a rather primordial meaning of substance. This is substance as where the buck stops, substance as what is most basic of all. In this sense, you could pick pretty nearly anything and say, that's substance in my metaphysics. If you think that the most basic elements in metaphysics are features, like agility or brownness, in such a way that things like this horse are basically just a bunch of features put together, then you might say, using the word substance in the sense currently under consideration, that properties are substance, and horses are not. Now, the meaning of substance that I just described seems to me to be lurking around sometimes in Aristotle's thought, for example, in the Metaphysics, which I'll discuss a bit below. But for the most part, I will not be focusing on this sense of substance here, but on others instead. So let's turn to look at substance in Aristotle's categories. The go-to place here is chapter 5 of that work. For an example of a substance in the primary sense, Aristotle gives an individual horse or individual human, and he says that these are neither present in any subject nor predicable of any subject. If a horse is a substance in this sense, what isn't? First, its color and agility, because they are present in it. Second, horse nature, because it, unlike an individual horse, is predicable of something, as when we say of a horse like cloud computing that it is a horse. So that's the first sense of substance. You can call it first substance or primary substance. There's another sense of substance in the categories, and in fact, we've already stumbled across it. It's roughly equivalent to essence or nature. So horse nature is a substance, but not in the sense that cloud computing is a substance. Cloud computing is a first substance or primary substance, and cloud computing's nature is a second substance or secondary substance. Now, the second sense of the word substance, second substance, has over the long haul turned out to be less influential. For a long time now, people who want to talk about essence or nature typically say essence or nature and not substance. This use of the word has, however, recently made a reappearance in the Roman Catholic liturgy, inasmuch as the new translation of the Nicene Constantinopolitan Creed says that the second person of the Holy Trinity is consubstantial with the Father, meaning, of course, not that the second person is the same individual as the Father, but rather that he is of the same nature as the Father. The sense that has turned out to be most important is substance as in first substance or primary substance. Rough synonyms for this are supposit, suppositum in Latin, and hypostasis, hypostasis in Greek and Latin. They just borrow it. The classic example has almost always been a horse. But cats, humans, and woodpeckers will do just as well. It's rather more controversial whether rocks are substances, and even more controversial whether tables are substances. And let's not even talk about atoms. But roughly, the idea of a primary substance is that of a concrete, individual, unified thing. It's this that we will mostly focus on in this talk. It would have been merciful of Aristotle to have bequeathed us only this account of substance, this distinction between first and second. But he gives us another account of substance in the Metaphysics, much longer and more confusing. At the outset of that work, he tells us that he's seeking a new science, a science of first principles, and after listing many things that that science should cover, he worries about how there could be a single unified field of study that was responsible for things so many and so diverse. He decides that what will hold the science together is a focus on ousia, usually translated substance. The science will be about substance and about other things insofar as they are related to substance. But what is substance? In Book 7 of the Metaphysics, Aristotle considers no fewer than six possible answers: essence, universal, genus, and substratum. The last of which can be interpreted in three ways: matter, form, or the concrete composite of matter and form. Life would have been so much simpler had he then identified substance with the concrete composite of matter and form, because that sounds like a horse. So then it would be the same doctrine as in the categories, you see. To make a long story short, however, that's not what he says. Instead, he says that substance is form. So it seems it's not a horse that's substance, but the horse's form or soul. This is famously hard to square with the categories, but if we think back to the vague and rough sense of substance that we began with, substance is where the buck stops, we can see that what Aristotle says in the Metaphysics is at least not random. Think back to the primordial sense of substance as where the buck stops. Compared to qualities like agility or brownness, first substance is indeed where the buck stops. Agility or brownness is always agility or brownness of some primary substance, for example, some horse. But now, focus on the horse itself. What is the buck stopper for it? One possible answer involves pointing to the most basic inner principle of the horse, and that, perhaps, is its form. So a primary substance is substance compared to things like accidents, but the form of a primary substance is substance compared to the primary substance taken as a whole. It is, you might say, the buck stopper within the buck stopper. It's the substance of the substance. Obviously, I'm using the word substance in two ways in that sentence. Another way to relieve some of the pressure created by the difference between these two works of Aristotle's is by noting that for a very special and superior class of primary substances, namely the gods, or in Aquinas' version, angels, to be a primary substance and to be a form are pretty nearly the same thing. I have said that the metaphysics and the categories offer different accounts of substance. I stand by that remark, but for the record, I feel obliged to point out that Aquinas would not agree. Aquinas thinks that primary substance is the main sense of substance, and whenever material substances are involved, he quite clearly holds that this means the concrete composite of matter and form, not just the form. Well, that's what Aquinas says when speaking for himself, but he also tells us that this is what Aristotle means, and indeed that it's what Aristotle means in the metaphysics. I have no idea where Aquinas gets that from. Perhaps it's just a reverential reading of Aristotle. Okay, we've already started talking about Aquinas' view of substance, so I'm just going to go on now in that vein. As hinted at already, the way he talks mostly lines up with the account in the categories. In this sense, he distinguishes first from second substance, and he identifies first substance not with the formal principle of a concrete individual thing, but with that concrete individual itself. I won't really say anything about Aquinas on second substance here, except to note first that he does use that language sometimes, and second, that he sometimes draws a subtle distinction between second substance on the one hand and essence or nature or quiddity on the other. Let's forget all that and instead just focus on the most important sense of substance, first substance. And now, finally, let's get into some details, which I've studiously avoided for so long. What for Aquinas is a substance? That's to say, what is a primary substance? Some paradigm cases of what Aquinas is targeting are the archangel Michael, the human Socrates, and the cat Rusty. And because it is often helpful to clarify substance by contrast with non-substance, let us also note a few paradigm cases of non-substances. Rusty's redness, a pile of sand, a severed limb. For Aquinas, none of these is a substance, although each fails to be one for a different reason. Hopefully this will become clear as we move along. So let me now present Aquinas' notion of substance, primary substance, by explaining four key points. Substances are individuals. They all subsist. They all stand under non-subsisting beings, and they are all unified. A primary substance, in Aquinas' view, is first an individual, like Rusty, and not a universal, like, well, it's not clear whether there really are universals in Aquinas' ontology, at least not in the sense that you're primarily thinking of. But never mind that. To repeat, Aquinas thinks that primary substances are individual. Linguistically, he thinks the notion of individuality is built into the meaning of words like supposit and hypostasis, with the result that it would be redundant to speak of an individual supposit or an individual hypostasis. I mean, you can say it, but you don't have to. But when he uses the language of substance, he will sometimes say individual substance, not just substance, so as to distinguish it from substance in that other sense, the secondary substance. The second mark of substance is the most important one, subsistence. According to Aquinas, a substance subsists, which means that it exists in and through itself, not in another. This can be illustrated by means of the following example. Rusty's redness does not subsist or exist on its own. It, the redness, exists only by inhering in him. Rusty himself, by contrast, does not exist in any other being, but instead exists on his own. Obviously, there's a lot to say about what that really means. A third mark of substance for Aquinas is that a substance is a substanding entity. That's to say, an individual that stands under its non-essential features, its accidents, in Aristotelian terminology. It stands under them by serving as that in which they inhere, by being their subject. Rusty, he would say, substands his redness, which does not exist on its own. But that redness exists only as inhering in him, as in a subject. These last two points, subsisting and substanding, are obviously related in Aquinas' mind. Nevertheless, they are not entirely on equal footing. Subsisting would seem to be more important for him than substanding, as the following reflections should make clear. To begin with, subsisting is, so to speak, what supposits do for themselves, while substanding is what they do for other, non-subsisting entities. What's more, it is only because they subsist that supposits can be substanding. Accidents inhere only in subsistent beings and not in other inhering accidents. Aquinas recognizes that we do say, in certain cases, that one accident, A1, inheres in another, A2. On his account, what is really happening here is that A1 and A2 are both inhering in one supposit, but A2 cannot inhere in the supposit unless A2 does. So we say, for example, that a thing's color inheres in that thing's surface, but really that means only that the color, which inheres in the thing itself, could not do so unless the thing had a surface. The point for us right now is that in Aquinas' thought, substanding, being a subject for, can be performed only by subsisters. Subsisters. Which means that subsistence is a more basic feature of a supposit than substanding is. A fourth mark of substance is unity. Unlike a pile of sand, say, which is not one thing, but instead many things, a substance is just one thing. Aquinas does not highlight the need for unity in his standard account of substance, but it seems to be implicit there. A supposit is a subsisting particular, that's to say, it is a subsisting particular, one subsisting particular. And at least one text comes close to addressing this directly. In discussing competing accounts of the unity of Christ, Aquinas indicates that a pile of stones is not a substance because it's not unified in the right way. So those are four key points about Aquinas' understanding of substances or supposits. They are individuals, they subsist, they substand, they are unified. We can round out the discussion by briefly adding three more points. First, Aquinas thinks that since they can exist on their own, without inhering in other entities, substances are wholes rather than being mere parts of wholes greater than themselves. Since Socrates' wisdom cannot exist on its own, but only as belonging to Socrates, it is by nature a part. Socrates himself, by contrast, can exist without being part of something else. So in that sense, he's a whole. Second, because non-substances exist only in substances, whereas, again, substances exist on their own, it is substances that exist properly and most truly and in the primary sense. Realities such as accidents exist too, of course, but in a secondary way. Aquinas sometimes expresses the point by saying that substances exist simpliciter, absolutely or unqualifiedly. By contrast, an accident or any other such non-substance is for him, well, just say an accident. It's for him not so much something that exists as something by which something exists. Socrates' wisdom, for example, is something in virtue of which Socrates is wise. Aquinas even goes so far as to say that while a substance is a being, ens, in Latin, an accident is really not so much a being as it is of a being, or a being's apostrophe s. It's entis. It's a little clever verbal joke there on Aquinas' part. He does that so infrequently. Well, it's not a joke, but you know what I'm saying. He also says that, strictly speaking, God does not create accidents, but rather concreates them. That is, he creates them as part and parcel of creating the substances that possess them. Okay, so third, supposits are, for Aquinas, not only what truly and properly exist, but also what truly or properly act and bear properties. Socrates acts, while his parts or components or metaphysical principles act only in the sense that by them he acts. It is Socrates that kicks a soccer ball, not his leg. Likewise, it is Socrates that weighs over 70 kilograms and not his weight. Socrates kicks in virtue of his leg. He weighs over 70 kilos in virtue of his weight. So that is a basic overview of Aquinas on substance. Now I want to shift gears and talk about how substance has been understood by a lot of metaphysicians working in the analytic tradition. Such metaphysicians have tended to take approaches that are not really Aristotelian or Thomistic, but instead either Platonic or Humean. I know that sounds weird, but I think it's true. It's not my idea. Seeing these approaches and how Aquinas' approach differs from them can shed some light on things. I'll start by presenting these approaches in the way that everyone does, as turning on a pair of distinctions that combine to yield four possible theories. The first distinction is the distinction between thinking of the features of things as universals and thinking of the features of things as particulars. Consider Rusty's agility, for example. Is it his personal agility, a one-off principle belonging only to him, numerically distinct from the agility belonging to LeBron James? Or is it rather agility, all in capitals, the one and only agility existing eternally in Platonic heaven and participated in by Rusty, LeBron, and many others? The second distinction is the distinction between thinking that substances are composed only of their features and thinking of them as composed not only of their features but also of a featureless substrate, sometimes called a bare particular. On the first way of thinking, usually called the bundle theory, Rusty's constituents are agility, redness, fullinity, and so on, and that's it. There's nothing in him to serve as the bearer of all these features. He himself is simply what you get when all these features are bundled together somehow. On the second way of thinking, Rusty's features aren't enough. We need also some non-feature constituent that bears them, a substrate that is in itself featureless. The terms of these two distinctions can be mixed and matched to make four theories. According to one theory, individual substances are bundles of individual features. Rusty is the bundle of his personal agility, his personal redness, his personal fullinity, and so on. According to a second theory, individual substances are bundles of universals. Rusty is the bundle of the Platonic form of agility, the Platonic form of redness, the Platonic form of fullinity, and so on. According to a third theory, individual substances are constituted by a featureless substrate and individual features. Rusty is made up of individual features borne by a featureless substrate. And according to a fourth theory, individual substances are constituted by a featureless substrate and Platonic universals. Rusty, on this account, is made up of Platonic universals exemplified by a featureless substrate. Each of these four theories has its strengths and weaknesses, and they've been debated to death in the literature. One of the theories, the theory according to which individual substances are bundles of universals, has fared particularly badly, although even today it's not entirely devoid of defenders. Lots of considerations have been brought forward, pro and con, for each of these theories, and naturally they exist in many different versions. I can't go into all of that here, but I will briefly point to three difficulties. The first difficulty is a difficulty for bare substrate theories. Briefly, a standard worry about bare substrate theories concerns whether any sense can be made out of the notion of a bare substrate. If we take such theories at face value, then our ontology must include constituents that are in themselves devoid of any characteristics at all. That's pretty weird. Now, maybe you're thinking, well, prime matter is like that too, and prime matter is okay. But there are important differences between bare substrates and prime matter. Prime matter is a potentiality principle, whereas bare substrates seem to be fully actual, or anyway, pretty actual. Prime matter is supposed to be numerically one, whereas bare substances are all numerically distinct from one another. This is a big, complicated issue, but at the very least, we should see that the analogy between bare substrates and prime matter involves a lot of non-similarities, as well as similarities. Now let's talk about a difficulty for bundle theories. How can it be that a lot of features, which presumably are features of something, that's to say, these features are inherent realities, how can they add up to a reality that's not of something, but instead, something? How can a bunch of things that are all of them of a being somehow add up to a being? Here, I'm reminded of Kierkegaard's punning joke about how you can't get a difference in kind out of a difference in degree. I can't tell you the joke in Danish for a number of different reasons, but Kierkegaard's English translator has figured out a way to tell the same joke in English. So here we go. You start with one Nis ball, and then you get another one. So now you have two Nis balls, three Nis balls, four, five, six, seven Nis balls, eight Nis balls, nine Nis balls, tennis balls. Pretty good, eh? So the point is that it doesn't work like that. If an accident needs a subject to inhere in, then it needs a subject to inhere in. And bundling it with a lot of other accidents won't make the problem go away. It will just make it worse. Otherwise, it would be like handling your debt problem by borrowing money. Not that anyone would ever try that. Okay, I do realize that Peter Simons has tried to address this difficulty for the bundle theory. He says my theory is not a bundle theory. Obviously, it's a kind of bundle theory that is meant to dodge this problem. I don't think his solution works, but I'm just letting you know, like, I know. Okay, for now, for one last brief look at problems with these four theories, this time I want to focus on change and contingency. Here, the bundle versus substrate opposition forces one into a choice between two unpleasant options. Bundle views tend to fall into the view that change is impossible. If a substance just is a certain bundle of features, and if change involves gaining and or losing features, then any change would seem to result in a different bundle, which means a different substance. Substances don't really change then. They pass out of existence to be succeeded by other substances. Bare substrate theories, contrastingly, tend to fall into the view that any change is possible. If a substance involves not just features, but also a bare substrate, and if the real heart of the substance is that substrate, then the features can change as much as you wish. As long as the substrate stays the same, the substance is still there. To put it David Armstrong's way, Bertrand Russell could become a poached egg. And it would still be him. I just put all this in terms of change, but the same points can be made in terms of contingency. Abstracting from whether a substance can change from being one way to being another way, we can ask merely whether a substance might have been other than it is. Bundle theorists tend to fall into saying, no, a different bundle might have existed, sure. But that's not the same as saying that this bundle might have been different. And bare substrate theorists tend to fall into saying, yes, and without limit. This particular substrate might have had any other features. Bertrand Russell might have been a poached egg. In presenting these four theories, I've skipped over a lot of details and a lot of distinctions. If my main goal was to give you an adequate account of the main analytic debates on substance, I would now make up for those inadequacies, or at least I would try. But it's not, so I won't. Instead, I want to return to the Aristotelian Thomistic approach and contrast it with all four of those theories at once. In so doing, I hope to enable us to understand all the approaches better, and maybe even suggest a way in which the Aristotelian Thomistic approach might be superior. Imagine that you find all four of those theories problematic. You find each of them problematic in its own special way. Perhaps you find one of them to be the least problematic, but still, you can't really get yourself to embrace any of them. What should you do? Now, one thing you could do is just to keep trying to fix the theories, and in the hope that eventually one of them will turn out right. But suppose you just keep trying and keep trying and keep trying. At some point, you might start to think that a more radical approach will be needed. Now, when you're in a situation like that, it sometimes helps to find some presupposition that all of the competing theories share. If some presupposition held by all the bad theories turned out to be false, then its falsity could be the cornerstone of a new theory that is an alternative to all the bad theories at once. Here's a proposal. All the theories share the view that if there's a substrate, it has to be propertyless. Let me say that again. If there's a substrate, it has to be propertyless. That's what they all seem to agree on. Let me put it a different way now. All the theories share the view that if there's a bearer, it has to be bare. Bare in the sense of, like, yeah. And if you think now that you're going to write a clever analytic philosophy article about nude particulars or naked particulars, all those titles have been taken. Okay, if there's a bearer, it has to be bare. Substrate theorists think like this, and since they accept the need for a substrate, they embrace a featureless substrate. Bundle theorists think like this, and since they reject the idea of something featureless, they do without a substrate altogether. But what if this presupposition were wrong? What if it were possible to have a bearer that isn't bare? A substrate that isn't propertyless? Aquinas and other Aristotelians hold just such a position. Its best known contemporary exponent is probably the late Jonathan Lowe, although his limited connection to the Aristotelian tradition seems to have made it hard for him to work it out as well as he might have done. The basic idea is this. What up until now I've been calling the features of things need to be divided into two camps, essential and accidental. Accidental features actually are born by substances as their bearers. Rusty bears Rusty's redness, for example. But essential features aren't born by substances as their bearers. Not if that means that the bearer is ontologically prior to the essential features. To put it bluntly, nothing bears Rusty's feature of felinity. Not even Rusty bears it. Instead, that feature constitutes Rusty. It serves as an inner principle in virtue of which he exists as a subsisting individual and as a cat. This, I think, is what Aquinas means when he says that substantial natures have no subject. On this way of thinking, then, a substance is constituted by its essential nature, and then the substance goes on to bear or substand its accidental features. This way of thinking evades the difficulties mentioned above. Because the bearer isn't propertyless, but instead has an essence, such as felinity, the difficulties involved in accepting a bare substrate are avoided. Because there really is a bearer, the difficulties involved in the idea that inhering accidents can add up to something non-inherent is avoided. And because the substance has an essence while also having accidents, the problems having to do with change and contingency are avoided. Rusty can change to be other than he is, and he could have been other than he is, because he can come to have, or could have had, different accidents. But Rusty cannot change to be non-feline, nor could he have been non-feline, because felinity is constitutive of him, and therefore any imaginary scenario on which Rusty isn't feline is a scenario about something other than Rusty. I've been helping myself to the language of essence and accident. I think I should now explain what I mean by them. The standard way of thinking about them in contemporary philosophy is this: the essential features of a thing are the features without which the thing cannot exist, while the accidental features of a thing are the features it has, but without which it can exist. This is not the way Aquinas or other Aristotelians think about it. Instead, they think something more, they think sort of more in the following fashion. Among the features of a substance like Rusty, many are derived from more fundamental features of him. For example, his being able to travel around is derived from his being an animal. For another example, his weighing 15 pounds is derived from his being an animal. Note that you can be derived from something even if that something is sufficient, even if it is not sufficient, I think is what I mean. Rusty's weight is derived from his being an animal in the sense that being an animal paves the way for his weighing 15 pounds. It makes it possible. But his being an animal doesn't necessitate his being 15 pounds. After all, if he ate enough meow mix, he'd weigh more. Anyway, all these derived features of Rusty are his accidents. But one of his features, namely his felinity, is not derived from any more basic or foundational feature of his. This feature, felinity, precisely because it is maximally basic and underived, is essential to him. Now let me make a clarification about Rusty himself. There's what you might call the whole Rusty, thick Rusty, big Rusty, who comprises his essence and all his accidents and whatever else you might want to throw in there, such as his individuating principles and his active existence. Then there's what you might call little Rusty, or thin Rusty, who comprises only his essence. Which is the real Rusty? I think the correct answer is that the real Rusty is thick Rusty. And that's what Aquinas thinks too, as far as I can tell. So when you think of substance, don't just think of the essence-constituted core. Think of the whole thing, the thing of which that essence-constituted core is the core. Moving on now, it's reasonable to ask whether this really avoids a bundle account after all. If Rusty, the whole Rusty, is a bunch of accidents born by an essence, then isn't he really just a bundle after all? A bundle that includes two types of features, essential and accidental, but a bundle nonetheless? The answer, I believe, is no. The false appearance comes from the fact that we have fallen into thinking of features as building blocks that we assemble to create substances. It's understandable why we do fall into thinking this way. Humans are best at thinking about primary substances. And so we have a natural tendency to think of everything as if it were a primary substance, even when it isn't. But we have to resist this tendency. We should not think of features as little blocks that we can use, or that God can use, maybe, to assemble substances, not even little blocks that are unable to exist on their own. Thinking of features as little blocks is wrong, and it's especially wrong with respect to essential features. building blocks are things that we start with, but we should not start with features at all. We should start with Rusty. Rusty is subsistent, unified, and so on. I said this before. It's maximally fundamental to Rusty that he be a cat. There's nothing in him that's prior to his being a cat. Nothing that gives rise to his being a cat. He just is a cat. So we can say that it's essential to him that he's a cat. And we can even say that he has the essence catness, but beware. Once you say he has catness, you are in danger of thinking of his catness as some kind of little block that's joined either to other little blocks or to a bare substrate. Don't say either of those. Say, he's a cat. His catness isn't some little thingy in there. It's more like Rusty himself insofar as he is a cat. Well, that's not quite right either, but it's less wrong. It's very hard to articulate this. What about his accidents? In addition to being a cat, Rusty is also red, agile, and so on. Since those are accidental, they are, as noted above, derived from what is essential about him, from his being a cat. Since they are derived from his being a cat, they must be really distinct from his being a cat. So it's reasonable to think of them as extra entities. Analytic philosophers would call them tropes. Scholastic philosophers would call them accidents. Of course, they aren't extra in the sense of lying outside of Rusty. To say that would be to fall into the trap of thinking that the real Rusty is thin Rusty. They are extra only in the sense that they go beyond mere catness. The facts about Rusty, in virtue of which it is true to call him agile or red, are different from the facts about Rusty, in virtue of which it is true to call him a cat. These accidents are perhaps a bit thing-like, or at any rate more thing-like than his essence. They are beings in a secondary sense. His essence is not even that. It's just the way he is at the most fundamental level. We must always return in thought to the concrete individual cat, Rusty. He is what exists in the primary sense. It's time to bring this talk to a conclusion. I've sketched out a more or less Thomistic notion of substance, and I've sketched out how it differs from the main theories of substance most often found in discussions today. I have naturally left many things open, and many other things underdescribed. Philosophy never stops, but sometimes philosophers stop. So I'll just say nothing more than this. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. This is a question about subsistence. So I think the second item on your list of Aquinas' marks of substance. I wondered if that for you was actually a complex of two notions, non-inherence and then this other one existing on its own. And I guess maybe the easiest way to see this is you have this example of things that don't count as substances, a severed limb, I think you mentioned. That seems to me something that's non-inherent. Suppose we take a hand.
A severed hand.
Well, before it's severed, let's say.
Okay.
It's non-inherent. A hand can't exist on its own, in some clear sense of can't exist on its own. But it's non-inherent, so it looks like it counts as subsistent. If we're thinking of subsistence just as the denial of inherence, it counts as subsistent in one sense, and Aquinas is often happy to say hands and other ordinary body parts are subsistent. But they're not complete in the nature of some species or something like that. So they would fail maybe your unity requirement. But they can't exist on their own either. So anyway, I guess this is just a request for clarification about subsistence.
Yeah. That's a good question. I can't give a good answer right at this moment. I want to look at passages where Aquinas says that hands subsist. He says a hand is a kind of he says it's a hawk aliquid, things like that. does say it subsists, you sure?
Yes,
but
we talked about whether the soul was subsisting.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, no, I know what passage you're talking about now. Yeah, I got to look at that. I think the problem of non-disconnected parts is a really, really, really tough one. And it may be necessary in a way to kind of deny that they're really there. Now, this is tricky because, I mean, you can sort of solve a lot of problems by saying, I know we all talk about hands, but really there aren't any. There are just people who are like this, you know, and then we call this a hand. And I must say, see, I think this kind of thing has to be open when you're interpreting Aquinas, because Aquinas himself, for the most part, it seems to me, is not much of a linguistic reformer. Like, if there's something that we say ordinarily, and it doesn't, and putting it that way is kind of misleading, it's, you know, it's what Weil would call a systematically misleading expression, Aquinas feels very little urge to scold us and say, don't talk like that anymore, it's confusing. He'll just do it himself. So, and he'll even sometimes say, you know, this is the proper way to speak, and then forget all he ever said that. So, that's a good question. I'm not sure.
Thank you, Doctor. I'm worried about identifying rusty with thick rusty.
Okay.
And the reason why I'm worried about that is you want it to get away from the bundle theory, because when we identify rusty as the bundle, well, once you switch out any of the elements of the bundle, you have a new bundle, and therefore you don't have rusty anymore. You have something else, rusty successor. And so I'm wondering, though, if you identify rusty with thick rusty, you still have a bundle. Rusty's essential core, his felinity, and then that's bundled with all the accidents, and now you seem to have a problem that you have identified rusty as that big bundle instead of just the core, such that once one of the elements of that bundle, any of his accidents, are destroyed, you don't have rusty anymore. And so, but I'm also sympathetic to why you want to identify rusty with the thick rusty. I'm just wondering how you're going to resist the bundle problem.
I did not mean to, maybe I've misunderstood you. Were you suggesting that I was suggesting that the reason for identifying rusty with thick rusty is to avoid these problems of change being impossible?
No, I'm suggesting, I don't know why you, I take it you want to identify rusty with thick rusty because that's just the intuitive answer about what rust.
Yeah, okay, yeah, so just let me make
but
that clear.
The problem is that if you do that, then it seems like rusty is corrupted anytime he loses any.
Gotcha,
effect.
Okay.
Just
yeah.
Like on the straight up bundle.
Yeah. So I think rusty's thick rusty. Well, okay. As a reading of Aquinas, I think I've just got these killer proof texts. And I mean, they say Socrates rather than rusty, but they say what I need. Okay. And I think Aquinas is right, basically because like take rusty and his redness is part of him. It's not something along. It's not like something in his backpack, or it's not his backpack. It's part of him. Okay. Now, the way to avoid that turning into a bundle theory, thick or thin, you're totally right. That's not the issue. If you construe them as a bundle, and if any of the parts of the bundle are optional, then you got a problem. Right. So the way around this is to try to avoid letting this account become a bundle theory. And what I was trying to say here to avoid that is that his felinity, his nature, is not like another element in the bundle. It's not part of the bundle at all. It's rather, and if we make a list and say these are the constituents of rusty, agility, redness, felinity, We've just said something that is systematically misleading. We've suggested that his being a cat is like his being red or his being agile, but it's very, very, very different. And there's a sense in which, you know, if I were setting up a very rigid ontological language that I meant to be the sort of language where you couldn't say misleading things, I would probably forbid people from saying things like, the cat has felinity. So you have a cat, and that cat is feline, but that felinity, that's a, like an abstract way of talking about the concrete subsistent cat. There's no, it's not a feature, and so it can't become part of a bundle.
Right, but now you are just identifying Rusty with thin Rusty.
I don't think so. Rusty is like Rusty insofar as he's feline plus whatever else he has. And that changes all the time.
I feel pressure because it sounds like you want to identify Rusty with thick Rusty, and it sounds like you want to identify Rusty with thin Rusty, but there's a transitivity problem.
Well, see, that gets into all these identity problems, right? Yeah, yeah. And like a lot of those, like, David Lewis worries, I think he's just wrong.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, I didn't spell that out.
That's fine.
So I'm really sympathetic with the general attempt to square the categories with the metaphysics accounts of substance. But I worry that often when we try to do this, we overemphasize metaphysics 7 through 9, and we underemphasize 12. And the analysis of substance that happens there. So I'd like to propose a fifth criterion of substance that both Aristotle and Thomas seem to recognize. So in the fourth lectio, in the commentary on the 12th book, Thomas says that for substances, the efficient cause and the formal cause are going to be identical in one of two ways. Either in natural substances, man begets man, and so the form is going to be the same as well as the efficient cause. Or in something like an artifact, the form of the house in the intellect of the craftsman is going to be productive of the house itself, and so house begets house in some sort of sense. And that seems to be some sort of criterion of substantiality that I don't think is captured in any of the four that you gave us. And I'm just wondering what you're thinking about that.
I don't see how it's connected to the metaphysics versus categories thing.
Oh, no, it's not. It's just when you're looking at the metaphysics in order to get criteria substantiality.
Oh.
That's one that I don't think is present in the categories, but not necessarily.
I see.
But also isn't as emphasized in 7 through 9 as it's going to be emphasized in 12.
Now, why is this a criterion of substantiality? I mean, you gave the example of artifact.
Right, and so this is going to depend on whether you think artifacts are substances
right.
or not, of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What if I say they aren't? Then it.
That's going to open up a whole bunch of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. I tend to think they aren't.
Subsisting in one way or another and so on.
But you think this fourth lectio of the commentary on Metaphysics 12 lends support to the view that artifacts are substances?
I do.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that Aquinas is reading it as such. And one of the reasons I think this is because he's willing to say that. In substances, both natural and in the case of artifacts, we have this identification of efficient and formal causality.
Well, that could be something that's common to substances and artifacts without artifacts being substances.
Sure, and then it's not going to be a criterion of substantiality.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, no, this is a good... I want to look at this now. Yeah, thank you.
I guess my question just kind of piggybacks on the previous two. You began by noting how there's the four senses in the metaphysics where we treat form and matter and then composite, right, as the different senses. And you can kind of maybe view that as, I don't know if this is something I'm not allowed to say after you listed all those things, but we can kind of break the composite into its two constitutive aspects? Or
yeah, yeah.
Okay, anyway.
We all do this.
Okay, well, so I guess I'm just wondering, you said you were going to view that or treat that, but it seems to me like that might be the necessary thing to kind of demarcate between thin and thick Rusty, in terms of it seems that we have form as substance, right? And so if we're going to say we want to talk about what is the substance, we're going to need to say what's the principle that we also call substance. We apply the same name, maybe not meaning it in quite the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like that's what was being brought up and as maybe a way to kind of deal with the identity change issues here. And maybe it's as far as Aristotle and Thomas get into form as cause, right, of the existence of substance, and therefore form and matter, to go back to the talk earlier, seem to be the causes of various accidents being able to inhere. So there you can say rusty is thick rusty, but the thickness of rusty is all dependent on the thin core that is in rusty, and since that's consistent throughout, whatever rusty takes on is going to be part of what we mean by rusty. You say rusty used to be this, rusty is this now, because there's the consistent core which is in some way causative of the other parts. And so we're not building him up out of blocks. We have something which is actually productive of, in some way, these additional...
Oh, you want to stress the point that... This is really interesting. So I think there's a number of points you made, and not all of which I totally grasp. But what I'm really now sort of caught by the last thing. So if you take my building blocks metaphor really far, then those blocks, well, no, I mean, this is an important part of it, right, or independent of rusty. And what you're saying, though, is that that rusty's accidents are, in fact, not independent of rusty.
Yeah.
No, that's good. Which is weird, because, like, Aquinas will sometimes talk about accidents coming to the substance as if they, like, fly in, you know. But on the other hand...
That's because there's an efficient cause, which is usually leading them to it, as opposed to its properties, like
right,
powers flow
right
from the essence.
Yeah. So, but even in that, even in the case of the ones that fly in because they're just externally caused... The substance itself still causes them by at least being its material cause, its subject.
By having it already,
that's it. It's not just that here I am on the substrate, bring it on, but also, right? But in fact, you know, it's because the thing has the essence it has, it therefore has the passive potency.
Yeah.
To receive. Yeah.
So the accidents already existing, the accidents that it's going to gain in a change already exist there potentially.
Yeah.
Therefore, every possible variation of thick rusty is kind of there. So,
well.
Maybe we're getting a little possible. We'll see.
Hi, thank you. I have a very short and therefore very big question.
Right.
Can substances combine in any way?
Yes, but of course it depends on what you mean by combine.
Yeah, that's open for you. So.
Right, I see. Yeah. So there are a lot of things. Okay, so one thing substances can do is they can combine in ways that give us things like friendships, baseball teams, people fighting, stuff like that. And those, I think, can be... Yeah, Father Brent asked us for an example of something that doesn't fit into any of the categories. And I was thinking, just being annoying to, like, over-interpret his question. Things like the Dominican Order, it's none of those. But, of course, it's reducible to it's a whole bunch of substances plus a whole bunch of relations, right? So things like friendships, you got, let's say there's just two people, to keep it simple. You got two substances, and then you've got a certain number of relations. So that's a way of substances combining. Well... Okay, now there's another way for substances to combine where some new substance comes to be, right? That's more what you're thinking of. Yeah, okay. So you take a little hydrogen and a little oxygen, and then you sprinkle a little chemistry dust over it, and you get water. Now the interesting question is, what happened to the... This is the question he was trying to bait me into talking about, and now you've done it. You've been paid. So the question is, are the hydrogen and the oxygen still there or not? If you speak in a studiously, carefully vague way, you can sort of say things like, well, the hydrogen and the oxygen went to make up the water, and they turned into the water, and blah, 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 and nobody can tell which side you're taking. I think that Aquinas, okay, if water is like a real new substance, I'm just going to assert that, like, for the sake of having a hypothesis to work with. If it does, then I think on Aquinas' view, the oxygen and the hydrogen are gone. And he says that they're virtually present, but by virtually present, he doesn't mean that they're present. He just doesn't. Okay? There's a long story I could tell about that, but I won't now. But, I mean, I'm willing to. Now, that prima facie conflicts the science that we call high school chemistry. So, and it's a really interesting question whether it really conflicts with modern science or not. And I believe one thing on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and the other Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. And on Sunday, I just try not to think about it. So it's a very difficult question. Yeah, we could talk about it more if you want. But.
Thank you, Dr. Grumman. Aquinas' doctrine of transubstantiation. How can one hold to that doctrine without committing herself to this idea of a featureless substrate with inhering particular features? For instance, in the doctrine, the substance of bread and wine is then converted into the body and blood, but the accidents and everything inhering in it is obviously not what we would expect.
Right.
So how can one not be committed to that and still be consistent?
So Aquinas says that the doesn't say that the accidents come to inhere in something else. And so a fortiori, he doesn't say that they come to exist in a bare substrate. He says that they come to exist in a way where they don't inhere in anything at all. They just don't inhere. Now, there's some sort of technical... Yeah, I'm just going to leave it stand like that. Okay, now, on the one hand, this is miraculous. On the second hand, it's not as crazy as you think, he says, because, look, whatever God can do through an intermediary, he could just say, I don't need you, intermediary. I'm going to do this directly. Substances cause accidents, so God normally causes accidents through the substances, but he can bypass the intermediary if he wants. Just like the king can just give you a message himself rather than sending the messenger. Okay, so that's the second point. Aquinas also says maybe we should rethink exactly what the nature of an accident is. And he says maybe it's not actually right to say that an accident is necessarily something that exists in something else, but something, I forget the exact terminology, but something that's sort of apt to, or that's not the right word. But yeah, it's sort of apt or disposed to exist in something else, but it doesn't absolutely necessarily have to. Now, one last little thing. I thought for a really long time that Aquinas held that view about how to define accidents only to solve this theological problem. But it turns out he has somewhat independent philosophical reasons, too. And you can find, this is all in John Whipple's book, The Metaphysical Thought of Aquinas. Like, it's this big, complicated thing. So it's not quite as theologically ad hoc as I thought.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Michael Gorman.